Welcome everybody, and welcome back if you are here for the meditation. Welcome those of you who are at home. Nice to see you all. I wanted to say something briefly about being together. I don't know, of course, what your lives are like, but a little glimpse into my life. I've been mostly home since the start of the pandemic, and I used to be in communities such as this one and many others like it around the country 4, 5, 6 times a month. And so this is quite rare for me. And even though it's very different probably for all of us, even several years into COVID, it's in a way much needed and feels kind of special for me. So I just really appreciate all of you being here, and I wanted to say that. It feels really good to be with a group of people practicing and talking about the Dharma. So tonight I'd like to talk about seclusion, and I don't know if my thoughts are going to get to the contentment part or not, but perhaps. I think my own choice to talk about seclusion says a lot about my bias, perhaps, as a human being and as a practitioner, and also as a teacher. I also feel almost a little bit insecure in a certain kind of way. I think sometimes I gravitate toward teachings that are not talked about as much, and I'm not an authority on who's doing what everywhere in the Buddhist world, though I read the magazines and I listen to a lot of talks and I log on to Zoom and practice with other teachers and colleagues, and I'm in conversations with students many times throughout the week about their practice and what they're reading and what's interesting to them. And seclusion is one of these teachings that I fear maybe is not so popular in a particular kind of way. And realize that it's very compelling to me personally as a student, and has played a very, very big role in my life as a meditator, someone interested in Buddhist teachings and the values inherent within those teachings and the possibilities that are evoked or aspired to in spending the kind of time that we do when we come to a place like CIMC. And also I think there is what I might call a caution with a teaching like seclusion. And I'll try to talk more about that toward the end. And I just wanted to point that out now before I really even dig in. The simple fact that the world we're living in, living at a time where people certainly are getting sick due to COVID, and there have been all manner of various stay-at-home mandates and shelter-in-place. We've had, some of us, a type of seclusion that we haven't necessarily elected and would not have chosen. And that has changed our lives in remarkable ways. And some people are very lonely. I probably put myself into that category of someone who's become a little bit more lonely due to COVID and how it's changed my life, right? So personally, I think this is a very good model for studying the Dharma. when teachings are raised by a peer or a book or a teacher, we might ask, well, what is the caution, or what is the other side of it? Because not every teaching is right all the time for every person, right? Or we might take a specific aspect or component of a teaching and identify with it in a really useful or skillful way and decide maybe that some parts of it are not right for me at this time, for example. I would like to ask for a moment, and we won't do this together as a group, but if you're open to it, just thinking for a minute to yourself, when you hear this word seclusion, what comes up? Images, memories, maybe even a definition. I haven't really said too much yet, so you can fill in the blanks. You know, what is Chris talking about? What does he even mean? So when you hear that word seclusion, what comes to mind? If I didn't already say it, or if perhaps I alluded to it and it wasn't quite clear, one of the reasons I'm choosing to talk about seclusion is not only because it has felt and still feels relevant to me as a practitioner, but I feel like it's a core aspect of the Dhamma path. And probably as a teacher, in holding it or seeing it or viewing it as core, and at the very least making an assumption that it's not talked about so much, that makes me want to explore it, just that alone. And to say that it's core means that I think it has a significant value. It has a very high function for us in our attempt to learn, A, what these teachings mean, B, how to apply them in our lives. Maybe even how to share them with other people. We don't need to be a teacher or be a volunteer in a Dharma center. I think at a certain point, we start to understand something about the Dhamma, and we start to find ways of sharing it with other people, right? Intentionally or just by our way of being in the world, by who we are or by who we are becoming. So there is, for most people, an iconic or maybe even archetypal image or notion of seclusion, alone nun or monk in a cave, right? And for anybody who's poked around in various religious or spiritual texts, or looked at on the walls in Dharma centers and certain sections of libraries, we see these images, right? A wandering ascetic in the forest. And we read such stories in ancient teachings, and again, we see these forms, we see these images in the world around us, and they evoke something about the religious life, spiritual life, quietude. We see a statue, and the figure looks serene or content, right? The Chinese recluse poets left us a beautiful tradition of wilderness poems crafted from their time alone in the mountains. Some of you might have heard of Han Shan, known as Cold Mountain. Hanshan wrote, "No one knows this. No one knows this mountain I inhabit, deep in white clouds, forever empty, silent. Cold Mountain is also the name of the mountain where Hanshan was said to have spent time, suggesting, I think, perhaps, that for Hanshan there was no separation at some point in his practice. In the poem, is the mountain forever empty and silent, or is Hanshan empty and silent? We don't know. We can make up our own mind. But if it's the latter, the poem, like many hermit monk poems, we could say it's an enlightenment poem. The central character awakened in part through their seclusion. And in that awakening, they are fully connected to everything else. The truth of impermanence revealed to the point at which there is no separation between Cold Mountain, the landmass, the actual mountain, and Cold Mountain, the person, the poet, the writer. So, not every student will be, not every person will be inspired by these images in the same way. One of the students I see regularly in my mentoring program, someone I've worked with for 5 or 6 years, said to me the other day, and I didn't introduce the topic of seclusion, and maybe it was even my conversation with her that got me thinking about this idea. And I don't know what she was talking about, but she looked at me and she said, "I don't ever want to live in a cave." I said, "Okay, that's not what we're really talking about, but fair enough, right? It's hard to get the temperature right. You can't cook a souffle on an open fire. It'd be quite a burden to live in a cave." But what she was saying is, like, I want to stay right here in the middle of my life, in this house, with this job, and these people. Like, I'm not going off alone with robes and one meal a day. This is my life. This is my life. I like my life. I'm suffering in my life, but I like it, and I want to be free, but I want to be free under these conditions, right? To other students, these images have some, but maybe limited value, and to some, these images might be very attractive while being perceived as hard to integrate into the world we live in. I have some students right now who are thinking about monastic life. I think that gets more rare as the years go on, as the world we live in seems to, at times, becoming, or in ways, becoming more and more secular. Perhaps sometimes people just want to get as quiet as possible to examine their mind as deeply as they can, and the idea of seclusion supports that. So how would we integrate this into a full life? How do you have seclusion if you're partnered, let's say, maybe, in living with someone else? How do you have seclusion alongside raising children, perhaps? How do you achieve seclusion with a full-time job and a lot of responsibility? How do you have seclusion if you live in a city? How do you have seclusion if your watch rings to tell you you're getting a spam call, your wallet in your pocket vibrates, and there's a computer in your bag, and your car talks to you, right? What does seclusion look like in that world? I think as Dharma practitioners, these are questions that we are tasked with fundamentally. And they are questions that not everyone in our society concerns themselves with. Most people are not talking about seclusion right now at 7:30 on Wednesday night. These are Dharma questions. So it can be useful to have these discussions together, in my view. in our Dharma centers, with our peers, other practitioners, with our teachers. Personally and vocationally, right now I have a lot of responsibilities and commitments, as do probably most or all of you. And since I began practicing meditation, this question, how do I find seclusion, has really been at the forefront for me. How I have responded has changed from time to time, though a few things have proven both consistent and immeasurably valuable. Quiet time in the morning when I wake up. And that includes, on most days, not checking my phone or my computer, not getting into email, not hearing news. And it includes periods of time throughout the year where I go away somewhere and I sit a meditation retreat. So those are like the core pieces. Trying to be as quiet as I can after dinner before I go to sleep. I'm not recommending that this has to be the way for you, but rather just sharing that, you know, in between that quiet time in the morning, quiet time at night, my life is very full. Sometimes I might say my life is very hectic. When either of these two things, the two core pieces, quiet time, and when I say quiet time, I mean waking up and going in a corner of my room when I used to have a small apartment to my little office now and sitting down and meditating. I didn't say that, but meditating in the morning and then a couple times a year going off and sitting retreat. And when either of these two important parts of my form, if you will, my practice form, I really feel it. I really notice in my mind and body. Something is lost. And the more time that goes by, the more that sense of loss is palpable. I'm getting further away from something that feels precious, important, crucially aligned with how I want to live my life. And some people who've been practicing a long time, and I've heard some teachers say this, that they've practiced so much that they can really let the formal practice slip a little bit, or they can just let it go for a period of time. And their insight, their wisdom supports them. And I'm not saying that that's not true or that that's not possible. I'm saying that for me, when I stop practicing, there's just a little bit of loss. I can feel something, some sense of stability, a little bit of quietude, my ability to pause and listen and observe my thoughts and feelings if I start to get triggered, if someone's doing something I don't like, that sense of just, I can hear what this person's saying, I can tolerate this, I can be here, I can hold this situation, right? I become, in a sense, less skillful. I would say then, for me personally, I feel more disconnected from the Dharma. Not from an institution, not from a set of ideas, but a much more internal truth concerning who I am and how I want to live my own life. So I really need the help of the Dharma. I really need the help of seclusion. I really need the help of meditation. Like many Dharma teachings, seclusion has layers of meaning. It has layers of understanding. As a rule, such teachings are generally grasped conceptually with relative ease, and then experientially, as time goes on and our relationship with the Dharma matures through practice. So my examples thus far have mostly fallen into the category of seclusion of body, which would be the first of three types of seclusion, seclusion of body. And this, I think, is the most apparent or obvious form or mode of seclusion. Take, for example, this evening. A group of us have decided to come here from, I don't know where you all live, but you left somewhere. You elected to come to Cambridge Insight Meditation Center, come up the stairs and into the Dhamma Hall. So that's a progression of seclusion, leaving your home or apartment or your workplace. So you left certain things behind, and you did that intentionally, I would assume. And then you came into the building, and in a certain way, and maybe you even feel that, like, maybe some of you come here very regularly, or maybe you're new, and even coming through the front door, there's this sense of purpose. Or if this is your home Dharma center, as we say sometimes, maybe even a sense of, it's quiet. I know I am here. What happens here is good for me. It supports me. And then you come upstairs into the Dhamma Hall and your phone is somewhere else, probably, right? And maybe you're just a little further away from duties and responsibilities, daily duties and responsibilities, tasks, right? Your to-do list, until I just reminded you of it, is home on the kitchen table. That's great. And maybe when you sat and meditated, the first thing that came to mind was your to-do list. But you have some protection. The Dharma is protecting us here. The Sangha is protecting us here. The people who put these cushions in a row and put the microphone here, put all of this stuff, set the TV up so people at home could join us, those people are protecting us, right? They're protecting the Dharma, and the Dharma is protecting us. So in a sense, we're secluded, just in a very practical way. We've left certain things behind. So secluded together, we establish a supportive container for our practice. In this way, this idea of seclusion, I think, is relatively easy to understand. And for anyone who has sat a longer meditation retreat, say of a few days or maybe a few weeks, sometimes longer, it is likely that you have experienced seclusion in a more profound way. The second meaning, or the second mode, I want to emphasize this idea of mode. The second meaning, or the second mode of seclusion, is seclusion of mind. Seclusion of mind. And with seclusion of mind, we begin to get a sense of how this basic notion of eliminating certain things or going somewhere or having even less around us begins to help us cultivate something inside ourselves. After we have created some space between ourselves and the pace and pressure of life through seclusion of body, we begin to see our mind more clearly. Things slow down, as a general rule, if our practice is consistent over time. Things slow down, and our inner patterns reveal themselves to us. It's not very hard, I don't think, to achieve this, though it takes some time and some willingness to learn how to effort in the right way. This is meditation practice. So I did some seclusion practice just recently. I'm about 2 weeks off of retreat, and I did a self-retreat, meaning that instead of going to a Dharma center, I went to a dedicated place. It was a small one-bedroom apartment quite close to here in Porter Square. And I had to fit my retreat into in between two obligations, so I had 5 days. And I was alone in this apartment, and I was following a retreat schedule that would be similar to a schedule we would be given. I was following a schedule that would be similar to what we would get if we were at a retreat center. So I was getting up around 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning, and I was alternating between sitting and walking meditation throughout the day. And in the afternoon, I would take a pretty long walk. You know, so those of you who know the sort of 8 or 10 or 12 paces back and forth, a traditional way of practicing walking meditation in our tradition, I would let that go, and I would just go walk around on the sidewalks of Cambridge and Somerville, right? I would try to walk a little bit slow, and I would be more free or open with my gaze, kind of looking around and taking in the sights and sounds, so forth and so on. So for the first 2 days of my self-retreat, I did have the support of seclusion, and I was really enjoying the quiet. I was really enjoying being alone, not everybody easily enjoys being alone. I'm fortunate in the sense that I can do that. So there's nothing to work through when I go on retreat. I'm just appreciating being alone. I'm fortunate in that way, because that can be a big transition for people. And many of you know, every retreat is different. And I was feeling not busy, like my mind wasn't very, very busy, but I felt a little bit numb, like emotionally numb, which I found very interesting and compelling, because there's some things going on in my life right now that are quite difficult. And I have made and or are going to make decisions that probably have long-term implications. So there's some stress. So to sit and begin to quiet the mind and to feel a sense of numbness or not have any real connection with my emotions indicated to me that there was some repression. Like I really wasn't letting the feelings in. And of course, I do that sometimes, but I think I'm more prone to vulnerability, to feeling what's happening, being scared or being, you know, being worried, or just feeling the rawness of dukkha, of suffering. And eventually on day three, all of those suspicions were confirmed. And I there was sort of a flood of emotion, and some sadness and some resentment and some anger. And so it was a reminder to me that in the context of my daily life and my responsibilities, I knew intellectually that some things in my life were difficult, that I had important decisions to make. Though, and I'm not even so sure it matters that we always understand the reason why, I wasn't fully connecting in my emotional body with the reality of those challenges, the reality of those decisions. That might make some people not want to go on retreat. However, what happens when we have the opportunity and the time and these kind of supportive circumstances where we don't then get distracted again, we can both feel the inherent vulnerability of being a human being and eventually moments where it's not experienced as suffering, right? There's this more organic and natural movement of thoughts, feelings, emotions, bodily sensation, and without getting entangled in them, they just come and go. So there's this sense of suffering and being okay at the same time. Suffering and being okay at the same time. Or suffering in one moment, and in the next moment, oh, interesting, I'm just fine. Right? These are just various sensory qualities or sensory phenomena that are moving in and out and around and amongst the body and mind, right? What we learn through practice is that we do not need to indulge every whim and desire of the mind. Not only do we not need to, but when we do, the mind contracts. The sense of difficulty has a way of growing bigger, right? Right. We seem to be in some sort of internal battle with the reality of our life, with the reality of our mind. Many of our thoughts are, they're compensatory and function to solidify a fleeting sense of self or otherwise to remove uncomfortable sensory experiences in the mind and body. Chasing our minds, many thoughts, feelings, and emotions is something that we do because we think it will make us happy. But it keeps us from feeling the inherent contentment and well-being of the present moment. This is to me a kind of great sadness, like capital G, capital S. This is a, when we really see this, when we're really honest about this, this is a great sadness for me. It is a disservice to ourselves and also to others to identify so strongly with the contents of our mind. When seclusion deepens, as it tends to on retreat, but not only on retreat, the mind grows quieter over time. Seclusion of mind refers to being secluded or separate from our habitual conditioning, our ways of seeing, our ways of perceiving and relating to life that cause harm and block our innate well-being. Secluded from unskillful and unhelpful mental activities and more prone to skillful and helpful mental activities. And again, I'll try to touch again on this when we get to the third type or mode of seclusion. There are all these stories in the Pali Canon about people going off, usually into the forest, and sitting alone and meditating. In many ways, you know, this is the modern version of that, or, you know, in your apartment, if you go off into a room where there's no people, and, you know, that's the modern version. There's one story that I like about a nun named Alavika, and I'll read a little a short passage about the nun Alavika. In the morning, the bhikkhuni Alavika, dressed and taking bowl and robe, entered Savati for alms. When she had walked for alms in Savati and had returned from her alms round, after her meal she went to the blind men's grove, seeking seclusion. Then Mara, the evil one, desiring to arouse fear, trepidation, and terror in the bhikkhuni Alavika, desiring to make her fall away from seclusion, approached her and addressed her in verse. "There is no escape in the world," said Mara. "So what will you do with seclusion? Enjoy the delights of sensual pleasure." So Mara is telling the nun, make sure you enjoy the delights of sensual pleasure. Think your thoughts, ruminate about the future, enjoy yourself. Don't be remorseful later. What Mara is doing is tempting Alavika to indulge the many sensory phenomena that invariably will enter her mind. Mara, the personification of distraction, desire, wanting, shows up time and time again in Buddhist literature to prevent would-be meditators from cultivating their mind and becoming free, right? Each of us has many Maras in our own life, in our own mind. Then it occurred to the bhikkhuni Alavika, now, who is that that recited the verse? A human being or a non-human being? Then it occurred to her, this is Mara, the evil one, who has recited the verse desiring to arouse fear, trepidation, and terror in me, desiring to make me fall away from seclusion. So, Alavika, well-trained and unwavering, stable, rooted, grounded, sees Mara for what it is, a temptation, one born of ignorance and lacking wisdom. Then, the bhikkhuni Alavika, having understood, this is Mara, the evil one, replied to him in verses, there is an escape in the world. There is an escape from self-generated suffering, which I have closely touched with wisdom, O evil one, kinsman of the negligent. I love this line. Kinsman of the negligent. You do not know that state. You do not know how to be free, she's saying, Mara, but I do. So she displays real courage, real confidence. She's very sure of herself, and she's willing to stand up to Mara. She says, sensual pleasure are like sword stakes. The aggregates, their chopping block. What you call sensual delight has become for me non-delight. She has found a higher order of well-being and peace in her mind and body by not following all the distracted movements of her mind and body. Then Mara, the evil one, realizing the bhikkhuni Alavika knows me, sad and disappointed, disappears right there. So anytime someone uses wisdom and does not revert to their conditioning, Mara just disappears, gone. We have that power. Just like the nun. When she explains that sensual desire has for her become non-delight, she is conveying that she is secluded from ignorance and wrong thought, and that she has aligned herself with the skillful means of restraint. In this story, as with many stories in the Buddhist canon, When those challenged by Mara choose wisdom over Mara's temptations, as I said, Mara just disappears. The disappearing of Mara suggests that through mindfulness, restraint, seclusion, wisdom, I would add to that kindness, compassion, generosity, our unskillful and conditioned responses to life fall away. We don't have to be caught in a battle with Mara forever. And we might need to slow down or create space between certain things, situations, or people in our lives to have the kind of clarity that recognizes Mara for Mara, and so that we have the kind of self-assuredness and courage and confidence to say, no, I'm not doing it. I'm not going there in my mind. Just like if an unsafe person asked you to go to a restaurant or the park, you might say, no, that's not good for me. I'm not doing that. I've done it before, but I'm not going to do it again. The third type, or the third mode of seclusion, and this is the final mode or type, is called seclusion of the hindrances. Seclusion of the hindrances. This points to a particular level of meditative development. Grasping and clinging have been seen. Grasping and clinging have been understood, and the habits associated with them no longer have strong sway over us. Sometimes they have no sway over us. So, in a sense, this type of seclusion, seclusion of the hindrances, is a continuation or a deepening of the second type of seclusion, seclusion of the mind. So the notion of cultivation, or in the Pali, bhavana, is important because it includes effort sustained over time. And I mean the effort sustained over, for example, the 45 minutes that we meditated together earlier. Sustained effort over 7 days throughout the course of a week. Let's say you meditate 5 days in a week. That's a lot of effort. Right? And then 5 years, and then 10 years, and then 15 years. I'm somewhere around like 25 or 26 years, right? Mental development is something that we work on. We can see this in the three stages of seclusion. First, we use restraint and renunciation, secluding ourselves from situations that are not accommodating to quieting the mind. With these supportive conditions, known as seclusion of body, we can more easily turn our attention to the habits of mind, stabilize the mind through concentration, and then observe the mind's activities through mindfulness. When we have slowed and reduced unhelpful pattern-forming habits of mind, we have entered seclusion of mind. The body and mind are both quieter now. If we continue to practice, eventually we will become secluded from the hindrances. A very, very high goal, and a threshold to insight that leads to wisdom, and hence real freedom. The hindrances are desire. Not all forms of desire are bad, and desire in and of itself doesn't have to be a problem. But it is a hindrance in that it is an obstacle. Aversion. 3, laziness. What's described as sloth and torpor. Like there's not enough energy in the mind and body to really engage our life and our mind and our practice constructively, or with the kind of attention it might benefit from. Number four, restlessness. Restlessness, worry, and anxiety tend to go together. Variations on a theme. In doubt. So we have desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, or not enough energy. Restlessness and doubt. It would be good to have some seclusion from those five, wouldn't it? Right? Right? And this is important to say, I think. We don't just practice and then those five hindrances go away. You know, we don't get a t-shirt and it says, like, I did it. You know? What do you mean you did it? The hindrances are gone. You know? I got the t-shirt, right? They go away. And we're paying attention. We're meditating. Mindfulness is strong. We've cultivated enough stability of mind. Ah. The hindrances are absent. What's here, right? An inherent sense of well-being, as I call it. A sense of peace. Or instead of sloth and torpor, a very high energy, almost a rapture or a bliss. People sometimes report, I understand that I'm very stubborn, and I understand that my mind operates almost exclusively in an attempt to get what I want. And I had this long period of time to practice, and I just kept wanting to do kind things for other people. And they're shocked. You know, and these are great moments as meditators or as a teacher, you know, we can just turn to somebody and say, that's your mind. That's metta. That's friendliness. That's your mind. Your mind does not just look out for yourself. It does that because it's afraid and scared, right? And having access to wisdom is actually quite difficult. But we can cultivate the mind so that it's prone to other things. Compassion, kindness, generosity, joyfulness, patience. Kanti, patience. I'm going to move in a moment to an attempt to wrap these ideas up, some kind of conclusion. Before I do that, I just wanted to point something out that if anything, I think is interesting, but perhaps more than that, includes its own teaching to some degree, that by looking across different lifestyles, not just the Dharma path, not just what the Buddha and those who came after him did, but recollecting for a moment that this notion of seclusion is not necessarily a Buddhist idea, actually. It's not necessarily something special that the Dharma has and other traditions or other way of being in the world don't have. For example, El Camino de Santiago, the way of St. James, the long walking path, right, in Spain, leading to the shrine of the Apostle St. James. Pilgrims every year walk this. I know a Buddhist nun in Burma, a teacher of mine who I've practiced with a few times. She was leaving them. I was leaving the monastery, and I said, "Well, what are you doing?" And she said, "I'm going to go walk El Camino de Santiago." You know, there's a Christian monastery near me where I live. That I live on an island, and there's this little little peninsula. It's almost like it's a peninsula, not an island, but it's almost an island off an island. And it's not always silent, but there's a lot of silent retreats that happen there. And lovely group of folks who sort of cloister themselves off far away from other people. And, you know, they do their dishes and read the Bible and walk and grow vegetables. And we would say cultivate our mind. They might say connect with Jesus, connect with God, right? The less formal tradition of long distance hiking or backpacking, you know, just people, you know, saying, I've had enough, or I want to know myself more. I want to know myself better. Or there's a divorce, or there's a job loss. You know, 3 months later, they're walking the Pacific Crest Trail with everything they own in their backpack. There was a lot of suffering in my life in my early 20s, and I was just starting to study the Dharma. Even before I fully trusted the Dharma, I would work Monday to Friday, and I would get in my truck, and I would drive up to North Conway, New Hampshire, with a backpack. I would sleep in my truck, and then I would wake up, and I would just hike until I had to go back to work. You know, it was very instinctual. I'm in pain. I'm going to nature. I'm going to spend some time alone. I had no context to support this, no study, knew nothing about what I'm talking to you about. But something in me had a sense, at least a hope, that this might offer me something, right? During COVID, right at the beginning, during the lockdown, not being very athletic at all and not at all being a cyclist, I bought a bike and began riding long distances by myself. And then I kind of, in a way, went back to my 20s. You know, instead of backpacking, I was strapping tents and food to my bike and going on long journeys in the woods and sleeping on the ground and cooking my food on a small camp stove. Having some external, if you will, adventure that was simultaneously introspective, right? Helping me make sense of this new world, this new COVID world. When seclusion is working, we feel we are getting closer to something important. Something significant, something meaningful, sometimes even essential. When our mind is not yet well trained, we experience a kind of withdrawal pain, the pain of not having the usual distractions that we count on in order to avoid our feelings. Withdrawal from constant stimulation. Not at all, I think, unlike the very real withdrawal of eliminating drugs or alcohol from the body. For many of us, we are, probably all of us at times, addicted to thinking, planning, problem solving, and numerous other activities that overstimulate the mind. All attempts to fill something inside us that feels lacking or missing something essential. When we are unskillful, because we're in pain or have not yet learned something else to do. We have not learned an alternative. We're not a bad person. That concept doesn't even really exist in the Dharma. We are, however, sometimes unskillful until we learn how to not be. And that's okay, right? That's where kindness to self comes in. That's where compassion to others comes in. At the beginning, I said there was a caution. When teachings, any teaching, okay, advocates really strongly for something, it often makes sense to point out a caution or simply things to be aware of alongside the main point that is being made. To state certain cautions is also to acknowledge that any teaching is an attempt to make a case for something, to highlight a particular point of view, and is not generally to be considered absolute or authoritative, or even recommended all the time. Seclusion, as I have talked about it tonight, is one aspect of the Dharma path, and I think it's a very important one. It's an element to consider at certain times, and maybe even often. Particularly as our world continues in all sorts of subtle ways to tell us that what I'm advocating for is absolutely crazy. This is old stuff. This is like religious folklore. This is stuff for the people who wear crimson robes and shave their heads. Don't let anyone talk you into seclusion. Right? Seclusion is hard. It takes effort before it opens up something beautiful in the heart and mind. In our culture, we want whatever we want quickly and without a lot of effort. That is not a good set of conditions for spiritual development. The world we live in might be making it more difficult to wake up. And I feel a kind of responsibility to just say those simple words out loud. Like, maybe if we're not careful, the world around us will make it harder for us. So I've simply made an effort to explain some possible benefits of seclusion as I have understood it through my own practice and study, through my own life, through my own experiences. It is also true that many of us, and to some extent, many of us have recently and continue to some extent to experience a type of seclusion that we did not expect or desire, in which we might also suffer from due to COVID, various forms of lockdown, and more broadly living through a pandemic. Not all forms of seclusion are beneficial. The seclusion taught by the Buddha is one that is self-elected. We choose it. It's tied to a purpose. It's rooted in a tradition. And it's supported by specific practice forms. The type and duration of seclusion is something we might discuss with a trusted teacher. COVID and the pandemic unify us in a very particular way, providing an experience at home that people all around the world are also experiencing. All around the world. That's remarkable. It's profound. We are provided right here in Cambridge, JP, Medford, Malden, wherever you are provided an experience that everybody in the world is experiencing. And also suffering from. At the same time, COVID alienates us and it disconnects us. Sheltering in place separates us from certain modes of living that were healthy and which we relied on for experiences of co-regulation with other human beings. Our new COVID habits often perpetuate further withdrawal from society and also from each other and also in a way from ourselves. We are not always aware that we are doing this or having this experience. And we make the mistake, despite how useful and pragmatic our many forms of technology are, of misconstruing them for deep connection. In the absence of body language, touch, seeing someone's eyes, something is lost in our relational life. In being at home with others, if we have the benefit of this type of companionship, and not everybody does, has its own challenges due to an absence of novelty, spontaneous activities, and diverse interpersonal and social connections. There is now a new collective fear that we have created and inhabit together, a fear that people and places will make us sick. Putting COVID aside, it is also the case more generally that people live through periods of considerable isolation and loneliness due to many things, including an absence of partnership, adequate socialization, and also that people toward the end of their lives often suffer from acute loneliness. Seclusion is a valuable asset and a cautionary teaching to be approached in a way that is personally relevant to you and your life, your practice, what you want from your practice. Your relationship to silence, your relationship to loneliness. And one more point about COVID. A forced, unstructured, stay-at-home lifestyle is not necessarily seclusion or retreat in the way I am using those terms to describe carefully chosen intentional activities with certain forms of support. And I think this is something that has plagued even serious, dedicated, very experienced meditation practitioners. The misunderstanding that, or the conflating being at home a lot alone with this type of seclusion or formal practice. It might actually not be that at all. It might just be being home alone. So there is a context and also a timeliness relevant to healthy seclusion. Seclusion, like renunciation, risks being relegated to the sidelines of spiritual practice. It might therefore be seen as something imposed upon us, and so we might get into a power struggle with the thing that could help us. But seclusion, like renunciation, doesn't take anything away. In seclusion, something is offered to us, and if we are open, something is received. Seclusion helps us experience the Dhamma directly for ourselves. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Lovely to be with you. I really appreciate you coming out. And for those of you who have joined from home online, it's really helpful to me as a meditation student and as a teacher to be able to talk with you and to feel your presence and to remain aware of your interest and aspiration. And together we're supporting the Dharma when we do this together. So thank you very much and hope to see you again. May you all be well. May the fruit of our practice be of good benefit to ourselves and also to those we know and care for at home and also to those we do not know and have yet to meet. May all beings be happy, peaceful, and well. Thank you. Have a nice night.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.